You're listening to Ink Studs, and my guest this week is Adam D'Souza. Adam, I've known for a long while now.
God, I don't even know how long. 10 years? 12 years?
When I first met you, you were working at a coffee shop.
Oh my God. On Main Street?
On Main Street.
Yeah, okay. That's like 12 years ago.
Yeah.
At least.
I think I just knew you because you're an artist in town, but I didn't really know your stuff at the time. You were just someone.
I don't think I was doing stuff at the time.
I was just drawing. I think you were just into stuff that my friends were doing.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Coming up to things.
Totally.
But things have changed.
A little bit.
It's funny, in prepping for this, to see just how prolific you have been in the past 5 years.
Mm.
You've got, let's do the math of the Four Blind Alley books.
Yep.
I only have the first two. I don't even know how I missed the 3 and 4.
They come out fast.
They come out fast. So you got the Four Blind Alley books. You've got The Gulf. So we're at 5. You've got Mutt.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the new zines, the 5 years on.
Yeah, yeah. Guest books.
The guest books.
Not really me. Not me.
But that's just like, that's more than a hand.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I sometimes feel like if I stop, I will... Like, all of my ideas will evaporate or I'll miss something. But I also think I do draw really fast.
Okay.
And I've been trying to slow down, which maybe it doesn't seem that way from the outside, but to take time and really choose what I spend my time drawing.
Some purposeful.
Yeah. I mean, it's all purposeful, but I think there was like a bit of a, if I don't make it, I don't know, it'll never happen. I don't know. Just a little obsessive, I guess.
When did you graduate university?
2019.
2019?
Yeah.
And that was right before COVID.
Yeah.
And you kind of had to figure your shit out, I guess, real quick.
Yeah. I feel like I graduated, I was doing, I had a children's book lined up, and I was also doing freelance work for the Globe and Mail. But meanwhile, I had like a $2,000 grant through the Ontario government to work on the second part of A Gleaming.
Okay.
So it was like a balancing act between this and that. And I always thought comics would be the side project because it just kind of necessitates that monetarily.
Yeah.
Even now it's always threatening to become that. But my professor or instructor at OCAD, Chris Kuzma, was kind of like, you just got to make comics. And if you make them, publishers will eventually get interested because you're good. And I took that really seriously. And it was really nice. It's like kind of terrible advice because it's like, well, I got to pay rent and I'm spending all this time working on a comic that I'm going to put out 100 copies of and maybe 50 people will read it or whatever. But in the end, the just making it kind of that philosophy just kind of worked out so far.
So before we dive too deep.
Yeah.
Is because your work is so centered, especially with Blind Alley, about childhood and the kind of whimsy of childhood.
Mm.
I want to know about your childhood. This is the...
Are we doing therapy?
I mean, could. I'm not a licensed therapist.
Okay, good to know.
I'm more of a Dr. Hibbert
type
therapist, so you may not come out of this as well as you entered, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I had a, like, quite good childhood as far as it goes. Like, my parents, despite being a little bit quite anxious people, like, I had quite a free range childhood. Like, I was running about, biking about, like running about with friends and kind of getting into trouble and stuff, but not in any serious way. But yeah, I think I'm attracted to that, like, that feeling of forming, like, having yourself forming, because I think childhood and coming of age are these times where you're like really you're experiencing culture in the world and being asked to like form a persona and test yourself against the ideas of the world and how you feel about them. Like, it's all there and forming. And I think now, even in my 30s, I don't feel like we ever arrive as people. Like, I feel like that's a bit of a trick. Yeah. But I think societally, it's easier to write about that when you're writing about kids.
Yeah.
Like, how the world shapes us and then how we kind of enforce that shaping.
I think the only difference is now there's expectations put against us.
Yeah, fair. Where it's like you're not allowed to fool around and fuck around and find out.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up kind of like North Surrey, which is a suburb, and it's a bit of a quote unquote rougher area, but I didn't
Wally. Really... Can we just say Wally?
Yeah, Wally-ish. Wally-ish. It was like Newton.
Okay.
More Newton. But I was there for 11 years. And in that time, like, again, like, my parents really let me, like, run around, do whatever. And I think I was always a bit naive to the world around there. Like, our neighbor got mugged a few times. And there's all this, always this sense of, like, please be really careful and, like, whatever, but I always felt safe and had a great time.
I mean, you're around, it's an interesting area in terms of, for folks that don't know, the lower mainland. The whole city is pretty, quite urban, but Surrey actually still has those little undeveloped pockets
in the
neighborhood, which
totally
can kind of shift how you experience things.
Do you know that... Sorry, this is getting so BC-based, but whatever, so is my work. The, that giant flea market, I think it's on King George, that, like, used to exist, and then it was just dilapidated and vacant for, like, 20 years. Anyways, I grew up near there, and I feel like that sort of, like, vacancy and that feeling of, like, it's, like, lower middle class people having a project car in the garage or on their driveway that's just rotting. Like, that sort of feeling, which I feel like very much made its way into Blind Alley.
Cinder blocks.
Yes, everything on cinder blocks. Holes in the fences and stuff. Like, when I'm writing Blind Alley specifically or, like, channeling that, it's a little... Blind Alley's more dilapidated, but I think it's, like, thinking back on that feeling as a kid of things rusting and kind of... wood melting into the earth.
Yeah. Being taken back by nature.
Yeah.
Your dad was an animator?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he worked at, works for a lot of places. Like, he worked at Nelvana and Bardell, and then the big job he had was working at Disney for a bit while they're in town.
Oh, okay.
But when I actually asked him recently how long that was, and it was only 2.5 years. So I always am like, oh, that was the longest thing, but I think it's just because I was a kid. And
was that, like, the mid-90s?
Yeah, that was probably... 96 to 99, which is such a brief period now that I think about it.
How old would you have been at the time?
Like six.
Okay, six, yeah. Seven, so yeah. That would have meant a lot to you.
Yeah. I mean, we had all the VHSs, and, like, I really grew up, due to the fact my dad was an animator, like watching old Disney cartoons and Warner Brothers and kind of endless access to comics. Like, he got me into manga kind of sideways through the Star Wars manga that came out in the late 80s or 90s, which is now impossible to find, but, like, that and Speed Racer. Like, I was really lucky that everything was just kind of accessible and not weird in the household either. Like,
when was the shift for you then to want to go from reading to making?
That's a good question. I think there was, like, when I was a kid, I just always drew. Like, my dad... despite the fact he was an animator, never, like, pushed it on me. I just always kind of wanted to draw, and I'd go to him and be like, how do I draw this, or whatever. And that kind of translated to my own love of comics. When I discovered Shonen Jump and manga, it was kind of over. Like, I would fill sketchbooks with ripoffs of Naruto or, like, Bleach or whatever. But I stopped drawing in high school entirely, I think partly... because I watched my dad go through just the animation industry just, like, rings people out. Like, if you're working in commercial animation, you're just kind of a cog in the machine. It doesn't really matter how you think about it. It's just, it's contract-based. Anyways, all of that, like, watching my dad struggle through that, I was just kind of like, well, this doesn't seem like something someone can do for a living. And it's ironic to think I eventually chose comics, but I arrived at it very organically. Like, I graduated from high school, had no idea what I wanted to do, spent 2.5-3 years working in a coffee shop, and then I don't even remember what it was, but, like, around that period, I think I went into Lucky's or even Golden Age and discovered some more alternative work, like Eleanor Davis, Michael DeForge, Thomas Herpich's White Clay. Like, those three artists were so big for me because I was kind of like, oh, you can draw whatever the hell you want. And at the time, I wasn't drawing that much. I'd sort of started drawing again, but that really kicked it off to be like, oh, I really love drawing and I can spend all day doing it
yeah.
in a way that, like, there's nothing else I can spend my time doing and not feel miserable. So I found my way to doing it just kind of organically through being like, well, I don't want to blow my brains out every day. I want to do something I enjoy. Yeah. And I kind of assumed I would have to do work on the side, and I still do sometimes, but I've been very lucky that so far Blind Alley and, like, bigger books like The Golf has meant I just kind of squeak by and draw comics all day.
And so your time working the coffee shop was formative in, like, a working class way?
I think so. I mean, I think it was very, like, it's funny, I romanticize it now where I'm like, oh, I miss working coffee. Like, it's a skill yeah. I have, but I definitely, I guess, what do you mean by that working class
well, way? Well, it just, it, maybe not necessarily working class, but, like, yeah. in a way that, like, informs what you want for yourself out of mm-hmm. life and what you want to do for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not, you know the thing, you know what you want from your life.
Yeah.
And doing that, you needed more than just routine.
Yeah, I think it really, again, I'm very lucky with my parents. They're always kind of hands off, being like, if do what you want to do. And I yeah. feel like there's so many stories of people being pushed to go to university before they're ready or whatever. But I think to me, that feeling of like wanting a life, to live a life that felt worthwhile, which meant that we're meant to work 8 hours a day. So that thing I did for my labor had to be meaningful. To me, really mattered, and it still really does. Like, I'm really bad at doing things I don't want to do, which is part of life. But I do think that was just an area where I didn't want to compromise. And I liked working in a coffee yeah. shop, and I still do, and I get nostalgic for it. But I do think there are so many ways I can imagine myself having gone to university too quickly and just done something completely that just makes me miserable. I don't know.
What would have alternative world Adam been? Like, computer programming?
Oh.
Useless arts degree?
I don't know, God. It's
communications.
The thing I would have gone to university for had I gone right after graduating would have been to study philosophy, which is even more useless than an arts degree. No offense. But, and I don't think I knew what that entailed. I think I would have failed. I had no aptitude for studying or reading or work ethic, really. Like, I barely made it through high school, so it's very pie in the sky. It's not something, I don't think I have the aptitude to do that now.
Yeah, no, it's as someone who did the full 4-year bachelor of arts degree, I did not do well with anything philosophy
based. Yeah, fair.
I cannot think in those conceptual terms.
Yeah.
So you decide to go to school,
mm-hmm.
OCAD, traveling across the country to Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
Not a quick, easy decision.
Yeah, I think, 'cause I met my partner, Lily, in 2014. God, I can't remember. Anyway, OCAD was not on my radar at all.
Yeah.
And then she mentioned OCAD, and we both independently applied for it, and we're just kind of like, well, if one of us doesn't get in, whatever. But I chose OCAD over Capilano, and I was looking at some schools in the States, but there's no way I could afford it, and I didn't want to go into debt to study art. And OCAD was relatively cheap. So anyways, it just kind of lined up because I really wanted to go to a school where the, like, technical parts of art making, like looking at life and painting and drawing, were, like, kind of the backbone of it. And OCAD's illustration program at the time was you do a painting class every semester along with a drawing class, where you're painting models, drawing, and whatever. And I didn't know what I wanted to do with art other than the fact I knew I wanted to draw comics, but I assumed I would have to have, like, a little bit of a practical bend to be like, you know what, I should technically be good at drawing.
Yeah.
So I found that really helpful. Like, it was a really great school. Toronto was an amazing city. And especially at the time, like, I was there, oh my God, like 2015, late 2014 to 2019. So yeah. It was like, there's so many incredible cartoonists working and, like, having events at the Beguiling and coming through town and doing events. So it was a really inspiring place to be a aspiring comics artist.
Yeah, it's quite a strong, stellar scene there.
Yeah.
And honestly, Capilano, it's more of a illustration program, like, for... It's not a deep illustration
program. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's not a deep...
I was actually thinking of doing animation there.
Okay.
Yeah, which would have been a totally different... Because it's quite commercial-based, like, yeah. Quite Disney method. And so it was kind of a freak method or Disney school was my thinking. And I think, yeah. Honestly, meeting my partner and her parents who are independent animators, like, just kind of pushed me to be like, oh, you can kind of do your own freak shit on the side, maybe. Yeah. Like, somehow. I don't know. But I don't think if I hadn't met her, I don't think I would have gone to OCAT. So it's interesting to think about. It's such a different life because now all I do is my freak shit. So
while you were at OCAT, were you exposed to kind of more conceptual type of art? Because I'm curious of how that works within your work, because you start out quite formal.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's based and just because you're in the city that has... you know, Patrick Kyle and Under the Forge and that kind of influence, or yeah. Were you kind of looking at other types of things through the school experience?
I think before going to OCAD, I did a fine arts degree at Langara.
Oh, okay.
Which was cool and like quite broad, like doing sculpture, painting, whatever. I don't know. I think generally I'm quite an interested person, so I feel like there are a lot of influences, and I think I'm an overthinker, which informs how I approach even drawing like my silly little throwback comic strip. Like, yeah. I try to think of it at a conceptual level and think about the form and why I'm drawing what I'm drawing, but also like the early work, which is on the table, like, which is a zine from like 2016, 2015. I was definitely trying to emulate and be Patrick Kyle or Michael DeForge. Like, there was this voice in my head being like, like, you gotta be weirder, dude. You gotta draw weirder. You gotta be cool. And I think it was really funny, jumping ahead, like, 5-6 years when I started Blind Alley, I was like, this isn't exactly cool. It's kind of throwback. It's kind of in its feelings. It's deeply earnest. And, but it also, I was finally like, oh, okay, this is just really fucking me. Like, this and the golf, like, this is me. I'm no longer trying to be experimental with how I draw a human form or whatever, but...
I feel like you had to work out, it's like, in music concept, it's like you had to do your noise album.
Yeah.
Before you could do your, like...
Yeah.
Your acoustic guitar.
Yeah, I still, like, it's funny, I look back at this work and, like, the old stuff, and I cringe a little bit, but I especially my sketchbooks at that time, I was trying so much shit, which I think is what university's good for. That I kind of, sometimes I'm like, oh man, can I bring some of that energy back into it? But maybe organically one day.
I feel like there's times where you do, where like when you're doing, there's a couple of different things that I see that you do. Like sometimes in a Blind Alley, you'll kind of switch up your style a bit and do something in more of a kind of sparser, blunter lines, a little rougher, like it has less preciousness to the brain. And I don't know if that's just I need to get a strip done quick, or if it's, I want to try doing something a little different.
It's probably all the above. Like, I do really, there are, especially early on in Blind Alley, because when I was drawing it, I was also drawing the golf. So it'd be like, I'd send off a chapter of the golf for my editor to look at and be like, okay, I maybe have a week. How many strips can I do? So I'd be drawing really, really fast. But I think, especially as the strip goes on, I've tried to make more time for it and be really intentional about how I'm drawing and why I'm choosing to draw that way. Like, I do think that's my favorite thing about cartooning, is that literally every line you put on a page can tell a story. So if all of a sudden you're doing really heavy lines, that says something different than if you're drawing with like a light line or a wavy line or something.
It's interesting, you talked earlier about being uncompromising and how Blind Alley is kind of, you know, as you're doing that in tandem with the golf, it is your kind of way of, even though the golf feels very personal, you're still working within a structure, with an editor for a book imprint of Random House.
Like, yeah.
There's all these really specific things that you're doing, you know, within an institution.
Yeah.
And Blind Alley, you're outside of that.
Yeah, I felt like I needed it. Like, I felt like I had a great time working with my editor and the art director. It was like, honestly, the gulf is like, I'm like, I can't believe you let me make this book. And also, I have only good things to say about that experience. But also, I feel collaborating was kind of scary in that you're like, there's a lot of stuff in the gulf that I didn't expect to make it into the final book or whatever. Maybe just based on my expectations on what a YA book is or what is what I believe a YA book is in general sense, or the experiences of other friends who made stuff. But I started Blind Alley just kind of being like, I want this precious little thing that is totally mine. And I'm really grateful that it's kind of the thing I feel like people have latched onto a lot. Because it is like, I think the weirdest and in some ways the most frustrating thing I make.
Yeah. Like, it's very, it's interesting because it's like, it's definitely not action packed.
No.
Sometimes there is action. When there's action, there's action.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's really about the quiet moments in life. And I'm interested about like that want to capture that want to slow down and give things so much breathing room.
Yeah, totally. I feel like the longer I work on it and the more I do side things like Blind Alley 5 years on, or like Mutt Mag had a Blind Alley story, the more I like, first of all, I realize I love Star Wars and I'm like, I never want to make a Star Wars thing. Like, I don't want this to be the type of story or world where it's like you can point at things and have like definitive answers. But I also realize how frustrating that could be to a certain type of reader, and that the longer I do it, the more alienating that might be. Yeah. But also, I think to me, it's about kids growing up in a weird place, and like what that weird place doesn't really matter, because growing up is kind of weird, period. Mm-hmm. Like, just, I remember that feeling of being a kid and like hearing my mom tell me she's stressed about money or whatever, or like all these weird things that I'm like,
abstract.
Yeah, I'm like, what, I don't know what that actually means, but I understand the feeling of it. Or maybe this is too specific, but I remember this feeling of being like, I don't know what the fuck sex is, but I know it's a big deal. And that feeling of being like, oh, there are things above me and people moving through the world who know things I don't and structures I don't understand. And I feel like that's the thing I'm really interested in, is like, being a kid is fucking weird and scary and strange, and it is kind of about, it's not about those big moments where things click together, because I actually don't think that ever happened for me. And that's like, that's the gulf and stuff, like, where it's just, it's all messy and weird. And I think trying to maintain that in Blind Alley and have some semblance of like forward momentum, I don't know, it's hard, but
yeah, I mean, you're trying, it feels like you're trying to, it's not as much as capture your childhood as much as you're trying to understand it.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And also, like, look at all these, trying to make, like, not specifically my, like, obviously there are pieces of my childhood in there, like, playing in an old rusted out car is, like, a thing I did all the time. But it's funny, I almost cringe when people are like, oh, it's so nostalgic, because I don't feel nostalgic when I'm writing it. I'm not nostalgic for childhood, because I kind of feel like, in a lot of ways, it was also scary and weird and awful and disempowering, especially the way society treats kids and talks to kids and expects them to be. Like, I don't feel that nostalgic for my childhood. I feel nostalgic for my early 20s, but that's a different story.
I feel nostalgic when it didn't hurt to stand up.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus, yeah. Like, I could start complaining about my hips, but I won't.
I see your Instagram stories of riding your bike.
Dude, I did a big bike ride this past weekend, and the worst part about it was my hips and lower back ache the whole time. So we're struggling through our 30s right now.
It just gets better. You know, going back to kind of that processing of formalism and like Gleaming, I found really fascinating, because it's like, I look at these other comics I got of yours, and yet they're art school, experimenting, messing around, trying to go through. And Gleaming felt like you're working your way towards a story, but you're also caught up in how you drew it, yeah. how you drew the characters and created them as their own symbols. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating and really beautiful, but I can see how it was trapped.
Yeah, totally. It's like, it's interesting to reflect on it because it's also unfinished.
Yeah.
And I made a Gleaming, the first one in, I dropped out of my thesis year of university and was just taking that class, and which was with Chris Kuzma. And I was like, fuck it, I'm just going to make a comic. Like, it's not going to be a little experimental short. It's going to have characters and stuff happening and whatever. And it's like such a 20-year-old person in their 20s making a comic, like, yeah. in terms of content. But
people having fun at a party. that is abstract to me on its own. I don't want to be out after 9.
Yeah, but then it's funny now because I would like to finish it. And I mean, I'm the king of having like way too many things on the go that I would like to finish, but I like genuinely would like to finish it as a person in my 30s now. But yeah. I do find it feels like writing with I don't know, 24-year-old version of myself. I don't remember how old I was, 26, 27, who knows. Yeah, it feels like writing with that person again, which yeah. I find challenging to think about, like what... Like, to finish that story and be respectful to what has come before, which is very much like, I don't want to think I'm a formed artist now, but I think I'm more confident in what I do now and how I draw. But I don't know, to also finish it off well. And
do you feel like when you're doing these little drawing tricks and, you know, is that kind of overplaying style over substance? And that's one of the...
I think so. I think especially, I think there's a lot of drawing in the second issue I really like. Like, I think I hit my stride with that one. But the first one especially, it's like, again, it's trying to be like, oh, I want to be Roman Murdoff or Michael DeForge or Patrick Kyle, like a cool artist I admire and who draws in a way that is interesting. And I think in some ways I have that more now than I've ever had when I just relax. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking more about the story as opposed to how I want to draw, whereas that was very much a style decision to be like, I'm gonna have open lines and unfinished drawings and smudges and stuff, and I like a lot of that. Like, I think it is interesting, but I also think it is definitely a little style over substance in some moments, yeah. where I'm like, oh, I'm losing you lose a character in this, and that's inevitable. Like, I think every artist has to do that, but yeah.
I mean, I definitely could see the Roman
yeah
in that book, and I think he would slap a pin out of her hand for doing the wrong thing,
which would be fair. But I mean it's funny now, it's like I'm going to be teaching at Emily Carr next semester, teaching comics, and like I've done some artist talks there and looked at students' works and stuff, and I do think emulation is so important to learning who you are as an artist.
Yeah.
Whether or not that emulation should be published is a totally different story, but I think that's just more an issue with the, like, my experience with illustration school was like, oh, you need a style. Everyone with a style, like, did well. And I think that kind of pushes you to emulate a little harder and than you probably should.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, not to talk about Roman again, but that's where I find him really fascinating, is he's actively destroying his style and breaking it down, and it's, you know,
it's fucking crazy.
The music, you know, it's like he's gone from doing like Pet Sounds orchestral to doing like minimal tech music.
Dude, it's like his drawings have always been something where it's like I look at them and I'm just like, A, how the fuck did you do that? B, please stop. And C, oh, I gotta get to my drafting table right now. And I still feel that way. It's amazing. Like, it's just the energy and the like deconstruction of cartooning. I don't know. I find it really, really incredible to look at. And I wish my brain worked that way.
One thing I think about is how, like, in kind of way pre-internet, pre-computer drawing, when your tools were more limited to a brush pen and a curl quill. And how people would just copy drawings by someone to see how they use those tools, and how
totally
that could have, I mean, that's more complicated now because I think you're a pen and ink guy, but for a lot of folks, especially because Roman isn't necessarily a pen and ink guy.
Yeah, he makes digital work. Like, I mean, there's a lot of beautiful digital work, but yeah. I do. I'm always impressed that his work is digital because it's just so tactile. Like, he's really working with it in a way that I think some artists succumb to the versatility and the kind of like endless quality of working in Procreate or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just like you can do anything. But he really, I don't know. This is the Roman hour. No, dude, it's awesome though. I actually, it's funny, like, cause I encourage people to copy art when they're in a rut, because I actually just find it to be the most freeing, and like, I learned so much from copying like a Moomin illustration, where you're just like, oh, I see how she's thinking as she's drawing, you know.
Would it be trying to use different tools as well?
That definitely helps, but even just like using a tool I guess sometimes you do have to simply use a different tool if you're trying to copy someone accurately, but I think interpreting someone into a tool you're comfortable with, just like if you're paying really deep attention to how someone is drawing, it teaches you a lot if you're again giving good attention to it, or else you're just copying it without thought, you know. I don't know.
Did you, you know, doing these formalist works and then kind of flipping and doing straight up YA with the golf, what was that change for you of like going into a very traditional direction?
It was definitely intimidating, and it was definitely, I don't want to say it was a struggle. It like kind of, I felt very lucky and very, like everything just kind of fell in my lap with it.
Yeah.
And because I also had the idea for the golf for a while, and I wasn't sure how I'd make it and what the format would be. But having to write like a script and then have an editor look at that script and really talk about a work pre-visual, like that the story was told as a script first, I found to be difficult. And it's something I consider with like the next book I'm working on, is how do I collaborate with this on someone while still having to be really visual, like the story be, it's a comic. It's like, I want the story to be rooted in the drawing, whereas I'm very proud of the golf, but I do think it's a dialogue heavy book, which works because it's teens hanging out, and I was that way when I was a teen, where we're just ribbing each other all the time. But it was interesting, and it also, I do feel lucky that I think my voice lends itself to YA quite easily, even if it's like an alternative YA. Just, I like writing about that time of life.
Tell me about the optimism in the book.
You think it's an optimistic
book? I do.
Yeah, I guess it is. Yeah,
it's a struggle to find yourself, but you find yourself, and you find your people.
Yeah, I think a lot of the book is me talking to myself as a 29-year-old, but also as like a 14-year-old or 16-year-old, and trying to balance that. I think it's very easy to feel cynical about the world, and I think I'm prone to depression or melancholy and overthinking, and I didn't want to make a book that is about how fucked up the world is and that's it. I wanted to make a book that is just, so I do truly believe that if you can sit in the mucky work of it all, the doing the dishes, and you're comfortable doing that, like, and or comfortable being uncomfortable, like, that's the work a person can do to make a better future. And like, even in like the best relationships, there's doing the dishes, you know. And I think that's a hard lesson to learn, because nobody wants to do the dishes.
No one wants to do the dishes. the big advice people are like, how do you, in a long-term relationship, like, well, it's, you got to be okay with not always being right.
100%.
Not having everything your way all the time.
Yeah.
And like, there's a certain happiness you find when you let go of control.
100%. And I think that's a hard thing to do, especially in this like very individualistic society, to think that, you know what, life is just embracing the fact you're going to be uncomfortable like 60% of the time. Like I used to hide in my home and avoid going to parties because I was just a bit socially anxious, and I was like, oh fuck, do I really have that energy? And now I kind of force myself to do it, and I'm much happier, if I'm honest. And I think like shit like that, it's hard to tell someone who's really struggling to just be like, or struggling with the state of the world to just be like, sometimes it sucks and you just got to embrace it and you've got to be uncomfortable in order to move forward. But I do really believe strongly in, like, not everything's going to be perfect in any relationship or politically or socially, and you just kind of have to keep doing that ongoing messy work, which is honestly just not giving up on it, yeah. Not getting bored, not getting tired,
yeah,
and still committing to it.
Part of this book, though, is also about completely escaping the world.
100%. 100%. Which I think is the
finding a different responsibility.
Yeah.
Finding the responsibility doing the dishes versus going to university.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the tension in me to the, like, the desire to escape off to a commune. Like, I have always been very interested in that, and again, too shy to pursue it.
Yeah.
But I think that instinct to run away, I don't want to condemn it. Like, I don't think it's a necessarily negative one. I think to want to live in a better world and to demonstrate it is kind of a lovely thing.
Yeah.
I do understand why some people think it's running away, but I also, I don't know, I don't think it's just that. But I think that's the tension of the book, is that even that running away to something better is not running away to... You're not running away from people.
It's running away from expectations.
Yeah.
It's running away from what is expected of you.
Yeah.
Versus what you want for yourself.
Totally.
And kind of figuring out what your autonomy is.
Yeah. And I think, like, you can, like, that feel, like, when I was 16, I was like, what the fuck is a job? Why do we all need jobs? And it's like, that's such a stupid thing to say, but it's also, I think, a preoccupation that has stuck with me, is that, like, oh no, we participate in making society every day, and there are so many different versions of it. And my next book is kind of about that, like, how we, if we all agree to create a society a certain way, that exists all of a sudden. And yeah. Like, that reinforcing of cultural, or the culture we inherit, you don't have to do that necessarily. You could question it. So even if it's stupid to say, do we need a job, it might be worthwhile to ask, why do we need to live in a world where this is what having a job looks like, you know?
So do you, how do you feel about your role within, like, or is there a type of collective responsibility we have for each other?
I think so.
In our place in the world.
I really think so. I mean, I don't know what that means, but I think it's really important to bear in mind that we live amongst each other whether we want to or not. Like, I think it's very easy to pretend we do not. But I try to conduct myself in a way that, I don't know, like, that people like me and I'm nice to them. I try to be more patient than I want to be. And if I'm grumpy, I try to own it. Like, I don't know. I think it's really important to exist in a world with people. And so I think running away and the golf and my next book and Blind Alley is all about living with people, because that's actually the hardest thing. It's like living with someone you vehemently disagree with. Like, I don't know how to navigate that, but yeah.
We all have to at some point.
Yeah.
You avoid a bit of it by not having a regular day job.
Thank God.
I don't miss coworkers right now. Yeah, when you started Blind Alley, did you think I'm just gonna keep going or just trying it out for a while? Where was the shift? What changed?
Wow. I have no idea, honestly. I think, first of all, when I started it, it was a fucking awful idea. Like, it was going to turn into Lord of the Flies. The dog was gonna eat a kid. Like, it very quickly wasn't that. As soon as I started it, I was like, that idea was bad. But the seed of it, it was that the thing that made me draw it is awful and has been abandoned. However, when I started it, I feel like I don't think I had any conception of how long I could or would do it. I think it was just kind of, we'll do this for now. I think maybe I had a year in mind because it felt doable. But yeah, now it feels like something where I'm like, I'm excited when I'm on a break from it. Like, I'm on a break from it right now. I might milk it for a year and just kind of like let it sit, because I think it makes it better and I think it makes me make better decisions. But I don't know. There's another universe where I'm like, man, if I could do this daily, like if syndication was a thing still that mattered, I would happily do Blind Alley daily. until it becomes something terrible and nobody wants it anymore.
Penny, the dog.
Yes.
Same Penny in the Gulf?
I don't know. It's all fake. It's all cartoons, man. None of it's real.
Did you have a dog?
Yeah. A golden retriever. Well, two golden retrievers and like a little terrible shih tzu mutt. Yeah. But I have a cat now. That kind of looks like Uncle Michael.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's how your cat makes it in.
Yeah.
Do you, with Blind Alley, it feels like it's spreading out further mm-hmm. and further and further.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you had some story beats, and those are kind of in there, but they're kind of gone to the wayside.
Yeah.
To just be an experience.
Yeah.
And how does your kind of process of working on that inform of how it's moving forward?
I think it's a selfish process in that I'm like, what interests me? Like, I'll follow some really stupid whims sometimes, or like abandon like stuff that doesn't even make it into the strip.
Yeah.
But I think it's this balancing act of really trying to just always keep the character center. I think the times when Blind Alley's at its worst is when it feels like it's mainly about the alley.
Yeah.
I always want it to be about the character's experience of the alley. So it's like, oh, Red thinks it's fucked up there's cameras because he trespassed on a friend by using a camera or whatever.
Yeah.
So that informs his experience of why he wants to break them, rather than just being like, whoa, look at all this crazy shit going on. Like, I think my worst strips are when I do that. But I should probably be better at managing it. But honestly, because it's a daily strip, I'm so much more interested in, like, replicating that, like, Peanuts form in this context. And I think there's something really interesting to me, maybe not everyone, about being like, oh, yeah, that was really weird what you saw a couple strips ago. But guess what? You might only see it 3 years from now again. Like, it actually didn't matter that much to the character. They're a kid and they're just like, oh, whatever. Like, yeah. I'm really interested in that, and I don't know if that strikes people as disorganized, but I think sometimes that's the experience of being a kid, and I don't know.
When I, you know, before hearing about the broken down car you'd play with, I definitely saw some visualities with Toyo Matsumoto's Sunny.
100%.
And I mean, that's such a beautiful comic in terms of just how he portrays these kids mm-hmm. and gives them, you know, a fully fledged identity.
Yeah, 100%.
And not treated like kids, but still children.
Mm-hmm. Totally. I think he's really good at that. And I mean, it's been ages since I read Sunny, but he's, Taiyo Matsumoto is like one of probably my foundational influences when I was getting back into comics. And it's something, yeah, I really admired about Sunny. And also just, I really love how he draws. And I've spent a lot of time trying to copy how he draws. But yeah, I definitely, like, I feel like with Blind Alley, it's also like a space to be like, yeah, here are all my influences. You're not wrong. You know, like, I constantly get Peanuts, of course, and being like, oh, is that Max from Where the Wild Things Are? And I'm like, no, but sure. You know, like, I don't mind.
You also, like, we talked, there's a little bit of action stuff, but it's really, conflict isn't the undercurrent.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about conflict, and conflict's not used as a
mm-hmm.
story beat in it. And I love this idea of just kind of being present and letting the quiet moments tell more of the story.
Yeah, thank you.
Than just chit-chatter.
Yeah, I think one of the things I'm interested in as a writer is, like, I guess non-Western narrative forms, like the kind of, like, straightforward, like, story is conflict. Like, I actually don't necessarily feel like that's true. Like, I think sometimes just an interesting character is interesting because they're interesting, or a thought is interesting because it's interesting, or just a drawing is interesting on its own. And I think trying to trust my instinct on that and not always be like, oh, so-and-so is upset with someone else, or there has to be a fight here because it's exciting. Like, I don't know. I think it's enough. And I think the comic strip form is really good at that because it's not going to be a whole narrative arc necessarily. And I think it kind of suits how I think about stories.
Yeah. Kind of summing into the style you've got with Blind Alley, taking away the formalism, the experimentalism, do you feel more precious with your work as you kind of fine tune and get to that point?
Yeah. I think the longer I've done Blind Alley, the more thought has gone into it, which is kind of funny to say. Like, I think a lot of people front load their projects, but for me it was just, I had like, I drew a bunch of kids in my sketchbook one day. I had that terrible idea I already told you about. And then when I started it, I looked at the kids I drew and I was like, I like these guys. Yeah. And kind of went from there. And then it kind of emerged on its own. And I think one of the things, I'm a very fast drawer, but I've just been trying to work on being a little slower and a little more careful. And that extends to everything in like how I tell stories and making sure I don't make weird slip ups. And I don't know, like I think it might also be the fact that Blind Alley has probably more of an audience than any of my other work, and just trying to really care for that and nurture it rather than just be like, be flippant with it, which I feel like I was flippant with Blind Alley for the first year and a bit, just because it was made while I was making a graphic novel.
Yeah. And now you're published in Spirou magazine.
Yeah, it's sick. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. It's been in the works for like 3.5 years maybe, so it's nice it's finally out there.
So how many strips are per magazine?
That's a good question. I think they did 12 in the first one, and I think it'll be less moving forward. But I know it'll eventually be put out in the same format as my books that I self-published, but in full color.
Now, self-publishing, you've only had a handful of things published by other folks. And you're not half-assing your book, like, months.
Thank you.
A hefty work. And I'm curious of that choice to go and, like, I'm specifically going to do this, you know, this book that is just as big as golf.
Yeah, yeah.
it's
too big.
it's not a half-assed collection.
No. Yeah.
And so, like, I can imagine that was a little... anxiety inducing.
Yeah, Mutt Mag kind of came out of, it was supposed to be with Silver Sprocket, and then I pulled out when I heard friends weren't being paid properly by them, and we don't need to get all into that because that is well documented everywhere, but suffice to say I was upset about it. I pulled Mutt Mag, like, we were in contract negotiations, but I was lucky that both Ari the editor and Karina the art director, they both left and were both like, we'll still contribute our edits, and Karina still helped me make it a really beautiful book, and I think, obviously it's self-published, so I paid for it, which I think I could only do because I view comics as like kind of a long-term thing where I'm like, I'll be going to festivals, I'll be selling 40 copies of it at every festival, hopefully, fingers crossed, every time I go, and I have 1,000 copies and that'll last however long. And so far it kind of works out, but yeah, I kind of made too nice of a book, I think. Like, it's got Pantone coloring and the spot gloss and stuff, but I think it was because I didn't want it to go from being a book with a publisher that had that premium feel to being a little bit more budget, which is stupid. It might be pride, but I think, I don't know, I really wanted to make something a little more careful and a little... like an object that felt like, oh, this is the first part of something new and stuff. So quite happy with it. It turned out nice, at least.
Do you see yourself doing more, or is that kind of,
Yeah, I definitely, again, I see myself doing more, but I also see myself working on another graphic novel, and also I've been picking away at another strip. So I'm telling myself the next issue will be next year, and it'll probably be half as long. Like, I was like 100 pages max, like, one short story, some brambles, and maybe a continuation of something else in there. But again, trying to slow down and be a little more careful, because I do think I'm proud of Brambles, but I think it was I learnt on the job with Brambles in a way that I also did in Blind Alley, but I don't think Blind Alley it necessarily felt that way. Like Brambles, I think I found the identity like 60 strips in or something.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it's something where you're kind of figuring it out on the way. And
like I had the character and I loved the character and I knew who the character was, but then being like, what is the, like I knew what it was about in wide terms, but then what it looks like as a strip.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with it. I think not everything I do has to be my best work ever, which is maybe insane to say on a podcast, but I truly like, I don't know, it's all parts of me. It's all...
You need to take chances.
Thinking. I don't know. It's like drawing's thinking, and you're seeing me work through something that's confusing myself, maybe.
Do you still, with each book, even as you're kind of contemplating new work,
mm-hmm.
are you getting... I don't want to say catharsis, because that's not what I feel with your work, but mm-hmm. there's still like a process of some part of yourself or your past that you're reconciling.
I do genuinely feel like a lot of... So for Blind Alley, this might not be as applicable, but for The Golf and then the next book I've been working on called No Place, like it does feel like there's a, like the narrative is a question. It's yeah. something that I'm reconciling in myself or being like kind of working through something, but not really expecting an answer, because I don't really believe in like need answers, especially with the types of like deeply existential or cultural questions I feel like I'm asking with my bigger work.
What do you see as cultural questions?
Like in this next book, there's a lot about gender and relationships and how we define those things as okay. that they are cultural institutions as opposed to something inherent to being human, and like stuff like that, and how a relationship should function, how we should be to each other even, and like almost in the sci-fi way, you know, of being like what if a society was like blank, you know, yeah. doing the Ursula Le Guin thing, but
interesting.
Yeah.
This will be a couple of years before we find
out. Yeah, fucking probably 5 years. Who knows? I'm like, oh yeah, it's a 300-page book, and the first half has no panels, and the second half is all tight panels. And it's like, okay, you have to draw that, dude.
I just want to put in like that DJ Khaled, like you played yourself.
that's comics. You're already doing comics. You played yourself.
Yeah. So you've got 4 Blind Alleys out. Are you doing any comic shows coming up?
Yeah, I'm doing the Prairie Comics Fest.
In the Winnipeg?
Yeah, Winnipeg in September? God, yeah. I need to buy my plane ticket. And then I'm doing Thought Bubble, and I'm debating doing Short Run. I applied for it, but I need to figure out if I want to go over the border with my books.
It's a thing.
It's definitely a thing. It's always been a thing, but it feels like more of a thing now. So
it's a thing.
Yeah.
It's you know, Short Run is one of my favorite, if not most favorite.
Yeah, yeah.
Comic show.
Well, I'll let you know if I'm going.
I'm happy I'm not an exhibitor.
Yeah.
At one of those things. Yeah. Have you been across the border since?
No, like other than to like pick something up at a PO box, and it just I feel like, yeah, before it's like people have been turned back from festivals bringing over books, and I think of it as a gray area legally whether or not we're supposed to be bringing over books, but I'm pretty sure it's probably illegal.
I don't know if it's illegal, like you can declare them, but it's less the bringing over books and more the... I'm not going to go any
further with this. It's fair. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I did Cala 2 years ago, which was awesome, and it was post-election, but pre-inauguration. And I also don't want to, like, it makes it sound like I'm, like, not afraid of the U.S. even under Joe Biden. And I was still like, yeah, when you go through the border, it feels like you're engaging with some sort of fascist institution in some respect when they're like, I don't know, they have all the power they want to pull you into secondary if they want. So I don't know, it's not something I have ever enjoyed doing, and it's only been made worse. So
now recently you did the guest book, the Blind Alley guest book, really is a fundraiser.
Yes.
And tell me about the charity that you want to support and kind of why that's important to you.
I chose Kalala Lilam on the Downtown East Side, which is an Indigenous health organization. I really wanted to do something that like felt hyper local and also in line with my politics, and it just seemed from, I like honestly talked to a lot of friends about it, being like, do you have suggestions? I'm looking at these things. And it just like through talking to a community of people who I respect, it felt like the best choice. And we've raised around $4,000. Oh, I need to double check. Still waiting to receive some money, but around 4K, which I'm really excited about, because it's not a small sum.
No, that's phenomenal. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I feel really incredibly grateful that it's like like around 60 cartoonists contributed to the book and like contributed their time. Like I didn't pay anyone. And yeah, it was kind of a dream to be like, oh shit, this many people were down to play with my characters and then also raise money for organization I care about. So,
yeah. Lovely. Well, thank you for joining me today, Adam.
Well, thanks so much, Robin. It's funny talking to you in this context.
Yeah.
Professional Robin.
This is what people can't see is I'm actually holding a cat in my arms.
And it is incredibly fucking cute. It's unbelievable.
Oh my God.